More than 70 years after the end of World War II, certain gaps in public understanding of the Holocaust present themselves again and again. Why were Jews the targets and Germans the aggressors? Why did violence escalate to mass murder? And why was extermination so swift and sweeping? Why didn't Jews fight back more often? And why was such limited help given from the outside? These are questions that historian Peter Hayes answers in his new book, Why? Exploring the Holocaust. It is published by Norton. Peter Hayes is professor of history and German and Theodore Zev Weiss, Holocaust Educational Foundation professor of Holocaust Studies Emeritus at Northwestern University. Again, he's the author of the new book, Why? Explaining the Holocaust. And we welcome Peter Hayes to the roundtable this morning. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular project?
Well, this is a book that emerged from lots of years of teaching and public speaking on the subject. I started teaching a course on the Holocaust back in the late 80s and was learning about the subject as I taught, and then I was doing a lot of public speaking, and it struck me that my students brought the same questions to class that audiences frequently raised. They were almost identical all the time. The things that people most wanted to know boiled down to a finite number of issues. And so I found myself repeatedly refining my responses to these questions. And it turned out that it was a lucky break for me that I had this experience, because I taught at Northwestern for 36 years, and I taught on the quarter system, which means you have to compress a course into a narrow space of about 9 weeks. And one morning I had the kind of aha revelation that these questions that people kept asking me were the natural structure of the course. So for years I taught the course as each week we would tackle one big question about the Holocaust, and we would move from week to week in that way. So when I got up to the point that I was on the verge of retiring, I said, maybe there's a wider audience for this, and I can produce a book that follows that format. And that's what I did.
So before we get into some of the individual questions, why do you think there is the gap of knowledge in something that is such a tragedy in this country's history?
Well, I think the gaps in knowledge that have opened up between what most people think they know about the subject and what most scholars think they know about the subject are the result often of a kind of wishful thinking. The subject is so enormously depressing. You confront the worst that human beings can do to each other, and you look for ways of getting that under control. And one of the ways to get it under control is to tell yourself that if somebody had done something just a little different, it would have been better. To take the most obvious example, if only we had bombed Auschwitz, we would have somehow been able to put this thing to an end. Or if only FDR had acted differently, or if only more Germans had stood up in the 1930s, and so on. I can go on forever on this. I think the difference that has opened up is that many people have ideas about the Holocaust that respond to that natural need for consolation. And scholars who've studied the subject over and over again generally come up with answers that aren't very consoling. And so that's part of the gap that's opened up. And the bombing of Auschwitz is obviously the easiest issue there, in the sense that by the time we became capable of doing it, almost everybody who'd been killed at Auschwitz was already dead. So the idea that if we had sent a few more planes in August of 1944 to hit those installations, that things would have been greatly changed is not true. And of course, at that point, Auschwitz was the last death camp that was functioning. Almost all of the people who had been gassed had been gassed long before that. So this is, I think, the reason for it. And it's hard sometimes to persuade people to look at the horror fully in the face.
You break up the book into the following sections: targets, attackers, escalation, annihilation, victims, homelands, onlookers, and aftermath. In that section on targets, you ask the very simple question, which I will ask you: why the Jews? And I guess looking at it as to why you felt that was a good place to start in telling the story.
Well, the Holocaust is primarily about the hatred of Jews. That is the driving hatred that is behind Adolf Hitler's policies. It's a hatred that rests on the notion that the Jews are enormously powerful and they are implacable enemies of Germans. And thus, so the question you got to begin with is, where does this come from? Where does a fantasy of that enormous proportion come from? And it actually has religious roots. It has roots in the rivalry between Christianity and Judaism. Christianity is, after all, a religion that arose out of Jewish roots and then said it had improved upon Judaism and offered a new revelation unto the world. And the Jews are the people who said, no, thank you. We have what we have, and we like what we have, and that's that. And so this religious rivalry developed over 1,800 years and rooted a kind of notion in Western culture that Jews were corrupting and dangerous. And then in the modern world, as that idea began to lose hold, Jews became emancipated from all kinds of restrictions on where they could live and what they could do. Many of them became successful in the 19th century at a time when economic developments and the Industrial Revolution and so forth were making life harder for other groups of people. And there was a temptation, which some people fell into, to say, follow the money. The people who are doing well are the reason why I'm doing badly. And that became what the source of the audience for modern anti-Semitism. Now, it had a loud and noisy following in the 19th century in many European countries, but it didn't become politically powerful until after World War I and the convulsions that Germany experienced. And then this political crisis in Germany, as it was political, social, cultural, economic crisis, every dimension involved, created an audience for people who believed Hitler when he said, the solution to all of our problems is to get rid of them. And even with that ideology, you know, when Hitler came to power in 1933, 55% of the Germans had never voted for him. So he came to power as a minority figure who was kind of put into office by people who thought they could make use of him. And once he had that power, then he translated his ideology into action.
And yet you make the point that anti-Semitism did not bring Adolf Hitler to power, that it was that crisis, that political crisis, that did.
Absolutely. And this is, of course, one of the most scary things about the history of the Holocaust, because many Germans thought they were voting for something else when they voted for Hitler or when they decided to follow him after 1933. And once he had power, he had the ability to magnify his own ideas. People, the natural human tendency to conform, as well as the fact that the Nazis had a monopoly on public discourse. It was the Third Reich was an echo chamber in which the same ideas were repeated over and over again, and no one was allowed to challenge them in public. That worked very powerfully on the young rising generation in Nazi Germany. And so one of the things you notice is the worst tormentors of Jews in Germany in the 1930s are often teenagers. People who are thoroughly imbued with this ideology in their school, in their youth groups, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it didn't take a majority of people being haters in the first place to produce this regime that persecuted Jews. But once the regime was in power, it could turn people into persecutors of Jews.
And you asked this question in the book, too, of why Germany, which opens up the question, of course, of why could it not have happened somewhere else?
Yeah, and that's a very challenging question. I think what we notice about anti-Semitism in the late 19th century, early 20th century, is there's, in many countries, a big, what you might call intellectual or cultural audience for it. That is, people write books that are critical of Jews or give you all kinds of rationalizations for not liking Jews. And people buy these books. Some of them are bestsellers. But when it comes to actually voting for somebody who says the Jews are the central problem, most Europeans kind of shake that off and don't respond to it. And in the United States, that's also true. But what happened in Germany was this profound and pervasive crisis that created the opening for these people. And people who were desperate in Germany in 1933, the Depression was worse in Germany than any other place in the world than perhaps the United States. And you had a third of the workforce unemployed. even the people who still had jobs, their wages had gone down and so forth. Other political parties had been inept in responding to it, didn't seem to have any answers to the crisis. And along came the Nazis and said, we're the ones who are energetic and firm enough to really deal with this. We're unconventional. We're not governed by preceding ideologies. Vote for us. And that worked, or it worked sufficiently to get them put into office as I say, with a minority of the votes, but more votes than anybody else.
We asked earlier why the Jews. And then from the next step to the annihilation, the idea of, okay, murder. And you asked that question in the book, why murder? Why was that necessary?
The short answer is because the Nazis run out of alternatives. When Hitler came in 1933, his hope was to drive the Jews out of the German sphere. And this was driven by a military analogy. He really believed that the Jews had stabbed the Germans in the back during World War I. They had been subversives at home. And he believed if there was going to be another world war in which Germany would emerge triumphant, then there had to be no Jews behind the lines, if you will. So the policies of Nazi Germany in the 1930s were to drive Jews out of the country. The problem was that the areas that Hitler hoped to expand Germany into, the living space that he had in mind, were all areas, or almost all areas, in which there were very large Jewish populations. And it suddenly dawned on the Nazis in 1938, after they annexed Austria, and then they went on and annexed the Sudetenland after the Munich Conference, that every territorial gain brought them more Jews than they had already succeeded in driving out of the country. And so the notion of expulsion wasn't going to work. They clung to it for the first 2 years of World War II. They dreamed of as they expanded into Poland, they decided, okay, we'll concentrate all of the Jews in these conquered areas, in cities, ghettos in cities that are close to railroad lines, so that someday we can deport them. But they kept running out of alternatives as to where to send them. They couldn't. The British didn't surrender, so there was no possibility of sending the Jews to Madagascar, which they dreamed of. The Russians refused. They tried to get Stalin to take 2 million Jews into the Soviet Union. He said no. Then they invaded the Soviet Union, but they did not conquer it in the first 6 months. And in this period, they gradually ran out of options and at the same time noticed that they had another way of dealing with the problem. They had the capacity to dispose of large numbers of people with very little allocation of resources. They could gas people with mechanisms that were readily available to them. Carbon monoxide gas is easy to produce with any motor vehicle engine. Zyklon is a pesticide that was routinely available around German barracks. It was very cheap. So that these two ways, you could actually get huge output of corpses with little input of resources. And once that became apparent to them, they had motive. They hated the Jews and thought the Jews were subversives. They had opportunity because it was under cover of war that they could do all of this. And then they realized they had means. And so this crystallizes in the fall of 1941 in a decision that, okay, we're not going to expel them anymore. We're going to literally banish them from the earth.
Peter Hayes is the author of the new book, Why? Explaining the Holocaust. It is published by Norton. You make the point in the book that the Allies could do little to impede the killing. Why was that the case?
Partly it's a matter of geography. We often forget because, but there are a lot of reasons why we forget this because of the way history unfolded after 1945. But most of the murders took place in the far northeast of the European continent. Three-quarters of the victims came from only three countries, Poland, Lithuania, and the Soviet Union. The area, the killing sites were all in that part of the world, and that meant they were all completely out of reach of American and British air power until the United States and Britain had conquered enough of Italy to go from the south up to bomb Auschwitz. They could never fly a plane from Great Britain to Auschwitz, bomb the plant, and get back on a single tank of gas. And the other death camps, where twice as many people were killed at the camps of Operation Reinhard than were killed at Auschwitz, those camps were even further east. The only Allied power that could have interfered with the process of gassing was the Soviet Union, and the Russians did not make that a priority. They said very little about Jews. Stalin mentions Jews in one speech during the Second World War. So they did not make it a priority to interfere with the process. And even when the Russian army in 1944 got within 100 miles of Auschwitz, they did not bomb the camp. So I think it's a matter of partly its geography. It was simply impossible to interfere with it.
When you look at the effect, and I found this interesting, the Holocaust made no significant dent in the German war effort. Give us a picture of what effect it did have and why that dent was not more significant.
Well, the greatest effect on the German war effort actually stems from events before 1939, because the Germans drove out of not only their own universities, but also by a kind of spillover effect in other countries. They drove out a number of very talented Jewish Zionists. And those people, in fact, several of them become instrumental in the Manhattan Project and the development of the atomic bomb. That's not to say that if they'd stayed in Germany, they could have developed an atomic bomb. Germany kind of pretty much lacked the resources to do that. But they were instrumental in the fact that we developed the atomic bomb. So that was an enormous loss to them. But other than that, the losses that the Holocaust entailed were very small, and the loot was enormous. What they stole from Jews in occupied countries was many times what they spent on rounding them up and deporting them and killing them. And we tend to imagine that a place like Auschwitz, where 900,000 people were killed by gas and another 200,000 probably by starvation, mistreatment, labor, so on, that this must have been a vastly expensive operation. It wasn't. It actually made a profit of about 100% because of the value of what they stole was twice as much as it cost to operate it. And the other gassing sites were even cheaper than Auschwitz and much smaller. The trains themselves were not very expensive. The Germans tended to use the same set of boxcars going back and forth between a deportation site and the camps. That meant that the train traffic being used for the Holocaust at any given time was a tiny fraction of all of the trains and locomotives and cars and so on that the Germans had at their resources, at their disposal. So, you know, it didn't make much of a dent in the German war effort because the scale of the war was so large and the scale of the process of killing the Jews was actually pretty pretty circumscribed.
When you look at, as I mentioned, the final section of the book is Aftermath, in which you look at the legacy and the lessons of the Holocaust. Give us a sense of what the takeaways you believe should be from what you write about and the answers to all of those why questions.
Well, I think the takeaways about legacies are that things can go terribly wrong, terribly fast, and that once they do, reversing that process is very hard. I think I quote toward the end of the book the story of a man in 1933 when the Nazis barged into an office of the National Association of German Industry on the 1st of April 1933, and they said to the director of this organization, "We want you to fire all the Jews and fire all the people who don't belong to the Nazi Party." And he hemmed and hawed and tried to maneuver his way around that, but in the end he knuckled under and he gave in. And one of the other people who was on his board wrote him a letter scolding him for that and saying, if you are willing to fire your own people and just cave into political pressure like this, what are you going to be willing to stand up and resist? And it was a great question, and very few Germans for the next 12 years had any good answer to it. So I think the first thing is to beware the beginnings, be very worried about excesses of political power getting out of hand. Other lessons of the subject have to do with the dangers of any political figure pronouncing to the world that everything is going to be better for us if we just get rid of this group that is dangerous, or everything is going to be better for us if we just suspend the rules and operate because our cause is just, and therefore moral restrictions should not apply to us. Because these are the messages that the Nazis sent, and they're the messages of demagogues and dictators everywhere. And that, I think, is the thing that I find most troubling about this history when I reflect on it.
Given our current political situation and the new administration, it seems, just in what you've said, at least for me, impossible not to see parallels.
Yeah, of course, when that question is posed to me, I always say, I always remember the story about if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I've spent my whole life studying the Third Reich and Nazi Germany, and so the danger is that I will always see parallels.
Yes.
But it does strike me that we are faced with a challenge to democratic norms and procedures, and we have to be willing to stand up for them in times when they're under challenge.
And I guess the question is we still have time to stand up against it.
Oh, yes, and we have many more mechanisms to stand up against it than were available in Germany in 1933. We have federal system. No dictator can come in and sweep away the states, which is what happened in 1933, where Hitler basically swept away state governors and state legislatures and replaced them with his own appointees and so on. That would be constitutionally impossible here, and that becomes a great check that we have. We still have free media in this country, and that's a very important source of that we need to hang on to in order to be able to check excesses. So we have a lot more resources in America right now, and I think we should cherish them and put them to work.
The name of the book is Why? Explaining the Holocaust. It is published by Norton. Peter Hayes, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Great pleasure to join you, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Why? Explaining the Holocaust. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.